Are you a picky coffee drinker with high standards? Well, rejoice if you're Canadian. No longer are you beholden to the selection offered by your grocery store or forced to make special trips to your local hipster Java joint.
Well, you know, one time I was going by this place called the Green Beanery, and I said maybe I'll go in there, but then I thought, no, we have a sponsor, a great sponsor, who sells a better product.
That's right. Our sponsor is Sparkplug Coffee, and they offer delivery all over Canada of freshly roasted, high-quality beans right to your door. Sparkplug custom roasts your beans when you order them in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and consistently delicious, and we can vouch for that.
Match that, Starbucks. Tim Hortons. Coffee time.
And we can vouch for this because we have been enjoying Sparkplug Coffee for all the months that they have been sponsoring
about
us.
About a year now, yeah.
This is not lip service. People, it actually is totally delicious, and you can taste the difference. So if you would like to get started and have your favorite coffee start coming from your very own kitchen, go to sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Fucking A. Hey there, Russian Rouletters, and thanks a lot for downloading the Top 100 Project, where we continue our quest to take a look at all the pictures on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the top American movies. Let it be known, we are about to spoil the holy shit out of this picture. I am Ryan Ellis with my dear stalking spouse, Bev.
That's me.
All right, a few warnings before we get going to this one here. We've got some rain outside. We've got some thunder, possibly, you might hear. The dog will be freaked out by that. We'll probably hear Fox panting. Neighbors are noisy on a Sunday afternoon. So early warning, if you hear that, that's what's going on there. We don't have a studio like we should. Soundproofed that Marin guy in his garage. Nice soundproof situation. But we don't have that. Anyway, the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, The Deer Hunter. How many more AFIers are about or have major scenes set in Vietnam?
I'm saying 3. Apocalypse Now, Platoon, and Forrest Gump.
She's right on it.
Bam!
And I said more, meaning after Deer Hunter. MASH is not even really a Vietnam film. That's where Altman intended. It's supposed to be set in Korea, but I did say more, so I implied to come. So you're right, 3 was correct. Vietnam, not a major topic in the rest of the project, but here and there.
I was surprised that there wasn't a few more Vietnam films. I think you really associate that serious topic with the great film moniker.
Even a movie like JFK has the theme underneath the whole way through because Oliver Stone was always obsessed with that topic.
I think it's a little surprising too that Full Metal Jacket isn't on the list. I always associate that with great films about Vietnam. The list seems longer than is represented on the list.
And as I said when we talked about one of the Kubrick films not that long ago, the Full Metal Jacket is one of the most rewatchable of all of his movies.
Yeah.
As great as the other ones are, 2001 and so on, Full Metal Jacket is one you can throw in there and enjoy. He wasn't always an enjoyable director. And this movie fits into that theme too. Not very enjoyable, as good or as great as it may be. And it is the Top 100 Project's 99th motion picture, The Deer Hunter, which was 79th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 between Rocky and The Wild Bunch. Then flew up 26 spots to 53rd in 2007. That's a big jump between Taxi Driver and the aforementioned MASH. EMI Pictures and Universal premiered The Deer Hunter on December 8, 1978, then released it on February 23, 1979. We think of it as a 78 film, but Roger Ebert, for one, had it on his best-of list in 79. The acclaimed movie was very successful at the box office. And to describe The Deer Hunter for you, Bev's got the skinny.
Robert De Niro is Michael, Christopher Walken is Nick, and John Savage is Steven. Three Pennsylvanian steelworkers who leave behind their blue-collar life to fight in Vietnam, where they end up trapped in a Vietnamese prison. After the three men violently escape their POW hellhole, they struggle to readjust to post-war normalcy.
Let's nutshell this film. Noisy gamblers witness drug addict aerate his own brain. Christopher Walken blows his own head off at the end of the film. All right, there's not as many numbers on this as we've had with Close Encounters last week, Star Wars before that, Rocky quite a few weeks ago. But here are some. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, very strong numbers, 93% of critics, 56 fresh, only 4 rotten reviews, and 92% of audiences. And the movie was 10th at the 1978 U.S. box office. Grease was number 1, Superman was number 2, but this is the only film from 1978, and this starts a string now where we only have one film per year. 78 is this one, 79 is Apocalypse Now, 80 is Raging Bull, 81 is Raiders. Many years we've had in a row with 2 or 3 or even more pictures. 1977, 76, 75, all those had multiple films, in fact 3 or more apiece.
The great films are drying up.
Although the one film that gets released each year is some of the best ones of all time. Apocalypse Now, Raging Bull, in the eyes of many people, they put those in that class.
It is a time in history when the studios stop being gutsy. You know, it's mm-hmm. the end
because of the Star Wars effect, because of the Jaws mm-hmm. effect, and Superman,
and because
as well.
Of the Heaven's Gate effect, which we'll talk about
yeah.
for this podcast.
This
for sure.
very same mm-hmm. director. All right. Well, The Deer Hunter. Bev's thoughts.
This is the rare case of a movie that I actually like better than I did the first time I saw it years ago. It's not without its flaws, but it's such a powerful, effective film that it doesn't matter, to me at least. The scene in the POW camp is perfect. Mm-hmm. That alone is a masterpiece right there.
Even though it's not supposed to be canon from Vietnam, that they actually played Russian roulette, and a lot of people were offended by that and call it racist, those sequences are among the most powerful that anyone has ever filmed for a Vietnam movie. Apocalypse Now is not a straight-up Vietnam movie either, really. It's so surreal and weird, and maybe that's also full of shit a lot of the time, too. But that's what makes those sequences so powerful, I guess.
Russian roulette may not have happened, but those scenes and what those men go through is this perfect distillation of what the personal experience of war would be like, because you have the trauma from random, extreme peril and inescapable danger, which is what these men go through in Russian roulette, but what every soldier goes through when there's bombs going off around them, every time they leave their base to go out on any mission that they're assigned, and they see every day the corpses piling up. They know that they could be next at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
But this scene, this short little experience that they have, encapsulates that feeling and conveys it so efficiently and powerfully mm-hmm. that whether Russian roulette happened or not, I'm not going to say it's irrelevant and that the criticism isn't valid. But at the time, there were other films about Vietnam that were incredibly sympathetic to the North Vietnamese. Coming Home and The Boys and Company C were kind and forgiving to the Viet Cong. So it's not like there weren't other voices in the fray that were disputing the portrayal here. So fine, you could suggest this was an outlier, that most POW camps weren't operated like this. There was just this one particular sadistic bunch of people.
Who are bored as well.
Yeah.
And they're going to bet against each other for who's going to live and who's going to die in this particular game. You said a short span of time. For all we know, this went on for weeks or months.
How many
it's a very
people?
Short part of the movie, granted.
Yeah.
Well, there are quite a few people in the water at first, and then towards the end, it's yeah. pretty much just down to our guys, Michael, Nikki, and Steven. And I think there's maybe one or two other people down there, but in the very beginning of those scenes, it seems like there's a couple dozen, maybe. And of course, there'd be more people shuttling through the whole time
yeah.
and getting killed, and they replace them with other POWs.
It's a war crime, for sure, and it's particularly sadistic. Would something like that happen? I can't say it wouldn't, and war is hell, and crazy stuff happens. But it does seem a little extreme. A lot of stuff in this movie is a little extreme, though. Mm. It's an exaggeration.
It's allegory more than a yeah. truth. It's not a documentary. People need to sometimes remember that no movie, unless it calls itself a documentary, is supposed to be actually documenting facts.
This movie reminded me, tone-wise, more of Gone with the Wind than any other Vietnam movie I've
seen. I would compare it to Best Years of Our Lives.
Best Years of Our Lives, yeah, but Gone with the Wind for the way it is melodramatic. It's hyperbolic. They are hysterical at many times, and everything's exaggerated, and it works because it's a melodrama and it kind of follows those rules. I mean, just look at the length of it. Just look how indulgent they are in every scene mm-hmm. and how long the movie is.
Well, a lot of critics compared this movie to The Godfather. We're going to get to the main and obvious comparison of that in a second. That would be the wedding sequence that opens the film. Before we do, though, here are some interesting names of people that are big fans of this film. All movie people, not critics. Jodie Foster, reportedly it's her favorite film. Milos Forman and Mickey Rourke love it too. Very weird diversity of people there. And you mentioned Coming Home. This was released the same year as Coming Home. Between them, they won most of the major Oscars. Deer Hunter won 5 and Coming Home won 3. There's similar content in both movies as well, and there really hadn't been a lot of Vietnam movies until around this time. Maybe because people needed those few years to get past it a little mm-hmm. bit. And then, hey, we've talked about it so much lately. Star Wars, such a red-letter film in so many ways, maybe gave people the opportunity. And Rocky as well, the year before that. Close Encounters, which we did last week, the end of 1977, that came out. All these optimistic movies that have a different approach than this one does, for sure, in Apocalypse Now, Raging Bull. But now we're finally dealing with the war towards the end of the decade. It does take time. There weren't a ton of Iraq films in 2003, yeah. 2004, 2005. It was more the mid to latter part of the 2000s. And even now we're still getting them. Hell, we still get Vietnam movies now. We still get World War II movies even now.
Oh, yeah.
In 2015.
And Deer Hunter was one of the first Vietnam films to really show scenes in Vietnam.
But not very many. The actual yeah. Vietnam sequences that aren't anything to do with Russian roulette, they're brief. We see De Niro, who's a changed man. We don't know how long it's been. They never even tell us if it's been months or years. And he flamethrows a guy who actually had just killed people, women mm-hmm. and children. So he's getting revenge, I guess. He's also doing his job. He's killing a North Vietnamese guy. And then Steven and Nick just happen to come along him from the same place. They get sent to the same part of Vietnam, and they're in the exact same helicoptered area of Vietnam.
The first of several outrageous coincidences. Mm-hmm.
But we have to cut the slack again in allegory, yeah. I guess. But after that, they go to the POW camp. They're underwater, and they're doing the Russian roulette stuff. And if that's not based on reality, then there really isn't more Vietnam in the whole movie.
Well, there's Saigon later.
Yeah, but that's not the war. That's post-war.
Right.
Okay, so I said that this movie compares to The Godfather, and a lot of critics did compare it to that for many reasons, and one of them is because both movies have a very lengthy opening wedding, which introduces most characters that we care about in the whole film. This one introduces every character we care about.
And a cultural community, not Italian like The Godfather, this time it's Russian, which is an important choice.
Yeah, well, you wrote all the last names down. I didn't do that. Let's scroll in your notes and see what they are again. Say them all.
Oh, why would you make me do this?
Well, just of their three main characters, Michael, Nick,
there's
and Steven.
Michael Vronsky, that's easy.
That's Steven De Niro.
Pushkov, yeah. Also easy. And here we go. Nicanor Chepaturevich.
They say that in the Vietnam hospital.
Yeah.
When Walken first starts going over the
and
edge.
And what does he ask him? Is that name Russian? And no, it's American. Because they're Russian, and they're very Russian. Like, they're very into that.
That wedding is extremely Russian.
Yeah, and they're very into the
although, they don't do that dance, you know, where you hold your arms and you do that, hey, 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 kind of thing. But other than that, the wedding seems to be very Russian.
Their parents are all speaking Russian, have thick Russian accents. Mm-hmm. They seem very proud of their heritage, but they're also certainly American. And I said it was important that they were Russian specifically because the Vietnamese War was a proxy war for
about
the
communism
Russian
taking
Cold
hold
war.
In Southeast mm-hmm. Asia.
But their loyalty was to America, and this movie makes no secret of patriotism, whether it's criticism or praise of nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
It plays a really big part in their lives.
The opening wedding has been criticized by a lot of people, also praised by a lot of people. No one really seems to ever criticize the one in The Godfather, maybe because the wedding's just a small part of that opening. It's mostly about Vito dealing with business in his office.
And the wedding really is just a backdrop for exposition, because you have Kay there, so she's the character that they can explain
everything
to.
She's asking the questions that we would ask as the audience.
Right, where I don't know if that's necessarily the case in The Deer Hunter, mm-hmm. and if it is, it's still way, way longer than it needs to be. It just goes on and on and on. I'm an editor, I can very easily point out how you could cut it in half without breaking a sweat.
Well, in that sequence, the Green Beret guy comes in there and drinks at the bar. He says only one line. Do you remember what that one line is?
He says, fuck it.
He says, fuck it, more than once.
When they ask him about Vietnam and tell him that they're going over there.
And they're excited. They're also drunk, but they're kind of looking forward to it in a way. The movie is set in 1967 in Clareton, Pennsylvania, which is 35 minutes south of Pittsburgh. And, of course, in Vietnam later on. So the ultimate small-town people who don't know better, they're going over to a place they don't understand, and it's near the very beginning of the war. I forget when the war actually started, but 67 is really before everyone knew just how much of a shithole that place was getting to be, and certainly would be in the years ahead. That Green Beret is what Michael could be later on. Michael actually is the toughest mentally and physically of the bunch, quite obviously, in those Russian roulette sequences especially. But even after the fact, he's got PTSD in a big way. That's very obvious. Mm. But he's not physically fucked up like Steven is. He hasn't lost his legs. And he's not mentally fucked up like Nick is, who loses his mind and eventually kills himself, even though he's got so much to live for back home, including a girlfriend and a job and friends.
So it takes being the toughest guy from this tough guy town to withstand the trauma of Vietnam.
And maybe he won't long term. It looks like it's been months since the war ended, or at least since they got back, Michael and Steven. Nick never does get back. And when the movie's over, it's kind of open-ended. Is Michael going to end up with Linda, Nick's girlfriend from before? There seems to be something going on there, but she won't meet his gaze at the end until the very last time, it seems, when they toast. She finally looks him in the eye, but I wonder if she's going to stay with him. Maybe she feels guilty. Michael was clearly into her long before.
Yes.
When he goes over to Vietnam, is he kind of dead already? Because he knows that Nick has proposed before they've gone over there. Maybe Michael, in a way, is already thinking, well, the woman I want to be with is marrying this guy. My best friend, though, too.
Because he's way too strong. He's way too strong to let a heartbreak destroy him. If he's not going to let Vietnam destroy him, I don't think heartbreak would end him.
I think that's debatable. Like, a lot of people could take war better than they could take a romantic heartbreak.
Maybe.
Others are the other way around.
I think he's more heartbroken by Nick killing himself. And he never tells Linda he loves her, but he tells Nick he loves him.
That's true. That's true. Well, Linda, Meryl Streep, first time we see her in the project. Mm-hmm. Only two films, Sophie's Choice is her other one. A lot of great movies in her resume. Adaptation, she's so great in that film. Kramer vs. Kramer, which was the year after this film, won the Oscar. This one won 78, it won 79. Over Apocalypse Now, great performance in that, her and Dustin Hoffman. The only other woman of consequence in the whole film, Ratanya Alda, who plays Angela, Steven's wife. She's been working for 45 plus years, still is, made a lot of movies with Pacino. And she married Pacino's bodyguard in the Godfather movies, Al Neri. That's Richard Bright, his real name. But Angela's maybe the cause of all this because she spills the wine at the wedding on her dress. That fucking bitch.
Way to go, Angela. It wasn't Johnson's fault for getting them into the war.
It's funny how they build that whole thing up. If you don't spill any wine, you'll be guaranteed good luck. And they make a very good point of a tight close-up on the wine spilling on her left breast. And her white dress has been soiled. And no one seems to notice it. Because when they finish drinking, Stephen looks at his friends. Yeah! He's so thrilled. I achieved this. I did it. Not realizing the priest just said, don't spill the wine. Well, she did.
Yeah, no one would notice anything at that wedding. They were too blind, drunk.
They were drinking before they went to the wedding.
It's not just the length of the wedding scene. It's the extremes to which these people party and drink.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually hard to believe that anybody would have the stamina, that one person would have the stamina to carry on the way these guys do, let alone every one of them. They don't sleep the day, as we point out when we were watching the movie.
Yeah,
this
is the they longest work. Day. Let's say they work 7 to 3. Let's break this down. So let's say they work 7 to 3.
Yeah.
Maybe they got off early, okay. But so they get off at 3. We're making that up. Maybe it's not even that time of day. It's also the fall or winter. Maybe not winter, but it's definitely colder. So there's no way the sun's going to be up till 9 o'clock at night like it would be in the summer. So it's definitely not the summer.
It is supposed to be the fall.
Okay, there you go. So it's probably going to get dark around 6 or 7 o'clock. They leave work. They go to the bar for a while. They fuck around there. Then they go to the wedding. And it's still daylight for a long time after that.
First they drink all night at the wedding.
And they all get dressed. Yeah. That's right.
And this is an Orthodox wedding. This is not an over and out. This is like an hour of your life. And then they get so drunk and do all that dancing.
It reminds me of Swing Time because you criticized so many things about that movie. And we've had some recent comments about your thoughts and my thoughts too, but more yours about Swing Time. We appreciate people
my thoughts
going all the way back, your criticisms. But one of the things you pointed out is that Fred Astaire's character, John Lucky, whatever his name is, that he goes to his wedding the day he's working. Well, these guys do the same thing. Yes. Although they kind of have to, I guess. He's this dancer. He seems to be doing pretty well in life.
No, but he's going to quit his job because he's getting married, which is another absurd, stupid thing about Swing Time. Why you would have to give up your performing job because you got married. He works the day of his wedding. Why don't you just get married tomorrow? Why don't you just quit your job one day prior
and to in this case, actually, because we started questioning the same thing in those long sequences in the beginning of the film, as they get ready to go to the wedding, all that stuff. Why are they doing this? Well, they're motivated by two things. One is Michael, Nick, and Steven are going off to Vietnam. It looks like it's on Monday. This maybe is a Friday. So maybe they had no other choice. They had to get this done because they're going to leave. But also, Angela's pregnant. And according to Michael Cimino, the director of this film, also wrote it, also produced it. Here's an auteur. We haven't had them as much lately. Woody Allen, I guess, was one of those. He said in one of the commentaries, I've never heard this before, but I read this online, the father of that baby is Nick.
Hard to believe, because Nick seems A, totally in love with Linda, and B, like a pretty stand-up guy that wouldn't do that kind of thing, but it does explain why he would be sending all that money to Stephen in the hospital, the VA hospital, because that money would be going to his child.
That's right. So Stephen's marrying someone who's not even having his kid, but having one of his closest friend's kids. And the only person who really seems to know that is Stan Stosh, John Cazale, his final AFI film. He had three, The Two Godfathers, Dog Day Afternoon, we cover that in the Not 100 Project and The Conversation. But he's the one that has trying to spread this scandal, it seems. And Michael's kind of pissed him about that. Shut up. Don't say that. Cazale was dying in this movie. We talked about that when we covered The Godfather Part 2, where his character dies. In this one, of course, he lives. Stan, Axel, and John. So George Zunza, who plays John, who owns the bar. And then Axel. Chuck Aspergren only made this one movie. He wasn't even an actor. He was never in another movie after this. He was an actual former at the steel mill when De Niro did his research. And they said, let's use this guy as one of our buddies. Wow. That's a pretty solid performance for a non-actor to give. But those three guys don't go to Vietnam with their friends. And they're obviously not as traumatized, even though they've lost their one friend to death. But here's Cazale's last AFI performance. Let's talk about him for the last time. What'd you think of him this time?
I think he did a great job, but it's hard because he's playing such a terrible character.
Annoying character, too. Yeah.
Annoying, but also, what a jerk. I guess in that kind of culture, they would stay friends with somebody they've known all their lives, somebody who would carry around a loaded pistol and wave it in people's faces and just act like a general jackass all the time. It's tough because he's so annoying, but his performance is exceptionally believable.
His character seems to be scoring with women on a regular basis, and then in real life, he was dating Meryl Streep.
Listen, he says he's scoring with women on a regular basis.
Maybe he's lying, yeah.
Yeah.
But in real life, this guy was with the young Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
How about
and
that?
It is hard to believe, even in his healthy days, that he ever scored Meryl Streep. He was a goofy-looking man. And he looks, unfortunately, just terrible in this film, because he's dying.
He had the cancer already.
Yeah.
Cimino insisted on him. De Niro paid for the insurance to cover John Cazale because of the fact that they knew he wasn't going to make it. Actually, not many people did know that. And then he died before the movie even came out.
Yeah, they shot all his scenes first because he was going downhill.
Yeah.
So Meryl Streep was recommended to Cimino by De Niro. Then she is the one that brought along Cazale. And in the script, the character of Linda, there really wasn't that much to her. She was just kind of the generic girlfriend. And it was Cimino that suggested that she write her own lines.
And she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for this film. So obviously the Academy thought something of this nobody. She'd been in a few movies before this. This was a breakout film for her.
And considering she's playing just the generic girlfriend role, she actually brings a real depth to it without sugarcoating the fact that she's kind of a subservient woman in this culture where she has no options, and she doesn't necessarily seem unhappy about that, but it does color her character, and it is a really great performance.
And she stands out looks-wise because Meryl Streep, who's never been the greatest beauty in Hollywood, but she's definitely an attractive woman, and compared to Angela and the fellow bridesmaids, she's a stunner.
Bill Clinton told Meryl Streep that Linda was one of his favorite performances of her entire career.
Big movie fan. His favorite movie is High Noon. He knows a lot about film. The first time we meet Streep, she's being beat on by her father, and then she's in this tug of war. It's not really actually a tug of war. It's a love triangle where there's no real conflict. Michael and Nick are best friends living together. She stays in their place when they go off to Vietnam. And when Michael ends up with her, it doesn't seem opportunistic. It certainly isn't a matter of my friend is overseas, so I'll take advantage of this. He doesn't seem to want to do it, even though he actually does want to do it.
She says, can't we just comfort each other? They already care about each other. There's so much potential for love there. And then they have this shared affection for Nick, who they are convinced is dead, I'm sure.
Well, we talked a little about PTSD, and that is a recurring theme in the war films on the Top 100 Project. Also, Coming Home has that in a big way. John Voight and Bruce Dern's characters have to go through that. Also, a situation where a guy's in a wheelchair, and the other one is mentally messed up. They don't have the De Niro character in effect, but they do have the Savage and Walken characters in their movie. I mentioned Best Years of Our Lives earlier. That, to me, is the film this best compares to. You'd mentioned Gone with the Wind. All three won Best Picture and a slew of other awards, for that matter. Well-respected in their day. And the PTSD theme won't really apply to Apocalypse Now or Forrest Gump quite the same way, although Gary Sinise's character, Lieutenant Dan, loses his legs. And the guy who goes through that, and Apocalypse Now, I say, it doesn't really have a PTSD element because the war's not over when that movie's over.
Well, yeah, but he is troubled. There is the whole scene in the hotel room. PTSD doesn't start when the war ends. PTSD
Well, good point. And then Brando's character has also flipped his lid over this war. And then Duvall's character is insane, even though he's actually a good colonel. Well, there you go. Good point. Not surprisingly, people in war are going through mental hell, and that was not something you really talked about even in the 70s, but it was getting to be more of an issue where people could actually admit, you know what, I can't deal with life. I came back from a place where I was mentally tortured by the experience of doing this. I'm actually going to speak out about this, because people didn't back in the 40s. It was something that was kind of buried in Best Years of Our Lives. That's the point. And then Vietnam, and certainly the wars that have come since, people understand, hopefully they do at least, that these soldiers, men and women, have to go through way worse than just the actual battle, and sometimes lose people that became close friends they never knew before. And in this case, the movie makes that worse because you're losing a close friend who was a friend before the war and during the war. So it's a double shot of pain. It's a movie that doesn't have sets. It's all over the place, a lot of outdoor scenes. They shot it in Pennsylvania, not really that much in Pittsburgh, and it isn't actually in Pittsburgh anyway. Ohio actually has a lot of the outdoor scenes. That's where that Russian church is. West Virginia, Washington State, where they went hunting. Those scenes in the cabin are up there. Zanira shooting at the deer the first time and the second time. And then Thailand's where they shot the Vietnam sequences. And the Philippines is where Apocalypse Now went for that. Obviously, no one was going into Vietnam itself at that point. Right around the same time we had to watch The Deer Hunter for the project, we happened to see Last Days in Vietnam, a documentary that was released last year that got an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, it was perhaps unfortunate because knowing how things actually played out in Saigon during that evacuation, completely inconsistent with what's happening in The Deer Hunter. So they said it during the evacuation. We know from seeing Last Days of Vietnam that if you weren't on one of those helicopters, you weren't getting out of the country. And if you weren't getting out of the country, you were dead. No. The notion that the army would bring Michael back by his request, I suppose, to just go visit Saigon and go on this personal reconnaissance mission to save an AWOL soldier. The army's not going to do that. They don't have the resources, their time, or the desire to help him do
Saigon
this.
Is falling.
And yeah, and then the idea that during a mass evacuation of crisis, they don't even try to mask. In fact, they're trying to dramatize it. Still, this gang of whoever these people are carrying on a Russian roulette game for fun. The idea that people carry on a Russian roulette game for fun is already pretty far-fetched.
It's not fun, it's money.
Well, it's gambling, which is a fun pastime.
Some of these people could be their career. It is for Nick. Looks it's like all still, he does now you know is what? Shoot up heroin and play Russian roulette.
If for some reason there was a mass evacuation of this city, do you think underground poker games would be going on? No, they would be wrapping it up and getting their asses
maybe
safe
they know they can't
the
get
city.
Out. I'm agreeing with most of what you're saying, but if we're going to talk about the movie being allegorical in the prison camp scenes with Russian roulette, and now when Nicky's doing it of his own volition, maybe all of these people, every single one of them, realize they're not getting out of there, so they might as well enjoy it while they can.
it's a hill too far for me. Too much for me to suspend my disbelief. And I see what they're doing, and there's parts of that scene that are effective for me, but I just don't buy it. There's way too many details about the end of Nick's character. I would have preferred, I think, if he had just disappeared and never come back. That they never found out what happened to him, because that's probably what happened to most people in Vietnam. Or just have him kill himself in the first time that we come across him in that Russian roulette den. And that Nick would have survived all those rounds of Russian roulette. That's even more far-fetched. He has a 50-50 chance of surviving every single time he plays, which means every game you add exponentially increases.
The odds are not in his favor.
Yeah. So, and he's meanwhile sending all this money back to Steven back home.
He's very good at this game. Somehow he keeps
on winning. Yeah, but it's not a game of skill.
It is the Hitchcock answer. I've had to give it to you many times. If he wasn't that good at this game, there'd be no movie.
Yeah, I see him saying straight
okay,
up.
Okay, let's move on.
All the film.
There is a foreshadowing about Nick's gambling addiction. You could call it that because he's winning money too. He's gambling no different than his boss is. Mm-hmm. Other guys are all yelling and screaming. He bets on car racing and football in the early scenes when we first meet all these characters. Mm-hmm. He's betting on everything. So maybe he was somebody who would have been a better anyway, and then that comes out of him, and that's all he's got towards the end of the film.
And perhaps his heroin addiction, as you see, he has track marks. He lost weight for the role. Mm-hmm. Would you say he lost 20 pounds?
Something like maybe more.
And he looks totally emaciated in that last scene that we see him in. Perhaps that's foreshadowed by his massive problem drinking with him and his friends back home in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Christopher Walken was in Annie Hall not long ago, the Best Picture winner of the year before this film, so he's in Two Straight. He's also got that small, memorable role in Pulp Fiction and probably 7,000 other movies in total. A guy who's acting a lot even to this day.
In Pulp Fiction, he's also playing a Vietnam vet.
Mm-hmm. I think that was deliberate by Tarantino. Yeah. Let's get a guy who was in a previous Vietnam movie, probably one of his favorites. I'm sure he actually liked Christopher Walken. He's never used him again in a movie. He was in True Romance the year before, Tarantino wrote, but he didn't direct that. That was Tony Scott. But what do you think of Walken's performance?
All the performances are phenomenal. He is great. He earned that Oscar. And if you were to see some of these lines written down on a page, you probably would think that they were cornier than they seem in the film. He sells it really well.
So the Zen sequences actually were supposed to have been reversed, incidentally. Michael was the one who was supposed to stay over there and continue playing Russian roulette and then kill himself. And Nick was supposed to go back and have his relationship with Linda. But it does make more sense in a way that you've got the main character. For one thing, De Niro's in most every scene in this movie. And we follow his journey the whole way through. Nick is not in the movie for a long time until we see him at the end. But then you also get the conflict of Michael with his friends, who he didn't really like all that much at times anyway.
Yeah.
He talks about that with Nick early on, about how if it weren't for you, I wouldn't want to go on these hunting trips at all. And that's where the name of the movie comes from, because they go out and they kill deer. And it's that whole thing about the one shot. It's a line that's used a lot early on.
Clarify for this for me, because I couldn't put together
it's a little esoteric. I think what Cimino and his many screenwriters are going for there, it's the purity of killing this deer, one clean shot. The thing dies quickly, and that's the end of it.
But then how does that play into the Vietnam stuff?
Well, maybe not so much Vietnam, but in Russian roulette, it's only ever going to be one shot. Either no bullets can come out of that gun, or you're going to get one in your head, and you're going to die.
I guess so. But it still winds up being like a pretty messy way to die.
Yeah, it does. But in both cases, you don't suffer long. We see the deer go down, and you were terrified by that. But I was reading it, and maybe you read the same thing.
Yeah, I read it too.
They tranquilize it. They didn't actually kill it. And they actually had it penned off so it couldn't run away and get away from them. It is horrifying the way that deer just goes right down.
But good for them for showing it. Because people criticize this movie and many movies for being too violent. But this is what violence looks like. It's showing violence, but showing the consequences of violence. Mm-hmm. It gets people in trouble. That is what a deer looks like when they're dying. That is what a man looks like when he's been shot in the head at close range. It should disgust you.
Yeah. And you asked that question about what the one shot means. I think the other suggestion, in a metaphorical kind of way, before these guys even know what they're getting into, because they don't know what Vietnam really will mean to them in the end, it's indiscriminate machine gun fire, which became such a prevalent thing at this point in our history. It certainly is true now. Guys, if they need to or if they want to, if they're just war crazy, that just shooting at everything versus you get that one clean takedown of your enemy.
And I guess it plays into the scene in the POW camp when they turn on their captors and attack them, because if Michael misses one of those shots, they're dead, and they all have automatic weapons. Mm-hmm. So they could have that rat-a-tat shoot at them in that less honorable way, whereas his practice of making sure he gets something the first time he shoots at it is perhaps what gave him victory that time.
And then he lets the deer get away later on when he's back home after Vietnam because he just can't do it anymore. You wonder if he's ever going to shoot anything again, animal or person.
I like that moment.
Well, this movie really captures something that many movies since have done about all kinds of wars, Vietnam, Iraq, multiple Iraq wars actually, Afghanistan. that regular people like this are the ones who pay with blood in wars. It's almost never the fortunate sons, to steal the line from CCR. It's those people that don't have very much to begin with that go over there to fight for their country and either lose their bodies, lose their lives altogether, or lose their minds.
And they go over not because they have to, but because they want to, because they have this real love for America. But by serving their country, that love is spoiled in a way. I believe they still consider themselves proud Americans at the end of it all. But that last scene when they're singing God Bless America, it's a grief song. It's as if they're grieving for what they once loved or believed about the country, about the naivete that they'll never have again.
You know, people have criticized that ending sequence as if it's anti-American. And I don't think that's really fair. I think that ending's very open-ended. Believe what you want about it. To me, it's just a sadness. I don't think it's them saying, America sucks, fuck America.
But they're allowed to be sad that America didn't live up to all the promises it made or...
And they lost their friend.
And they lost their friend for America.
You know, the way they sing that song, the tone they sing that song, maybe it's actually hopeful. Yeah. Maybe it's them saying, we're going to try to rebuild this because the rest of us are alive. Poor Steve lost his legs. But everybody else maybe has a chance now to do something with this and take something good out of this horrible, shitty situation.
And is patriotism, does that mean ignoring the faults in your country or the sacrifices that you have to make to keep this country that you love?
I don't think it does at all.
No.
A lot of people have been called un-American ever since 9/11. Way more often than not, they're the people that want the country to do better, to be better, to act better than they are, rather than this love or leave it, Toby Keith bullshit. Mm-hmm. Can put a boot in your ass. What does that say? I'd rather have somebody who says, I love my country, but I want it to think more. I want it to act better towards the rest of the world.
Yeah, I see it less as criticism and more as a nuanced view of America.
This is a great companion piece to The Hurt Locker, too. That movie that won the Oscar not that long ago. Yeah. And that one is about the Iraq War.
Also won Best Picture.
Mm-hmm. The Academy has picked a lot of war films to win the big awards. Even the movies that just have an element of it, like Gone with the Wind with the Civil War. So our star, Robert De Niro's third AFI film, is The Deer Hunter. He was in The Godfather Part II, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull's not that long away, and then Goodfellas. What an incredible resume that is. His line, this is this, which is aimed at Stan, leads into the from now on your own. Because when they go hunting without Steven, because he's on his honeymoon with Angela, he's talking to Stan in both of those cases. He's already been a bit of a hard ass on this guy. Stan would not have made it out of Vietnam, I don't think. If he did, it would have been damn lucky. But even at that point, Michael is kind of pulling away from his friends.
He's a little detached.
And he doesn't seem to ever like or respect Stan. Hell, he puts a loaded gun to his forehead later on in the movie.
So they actually had a live round in the gun when they
Not
did that.
In the chamber.
Not in the chamber, but they really played it as if it was real Russian roulette, although apparently Ghazal obsessively checked the gun to make sure that it wasn't in the chamber. But he knew that just knowing there was a live round in the gun would make his performance that much more convincing, and it is very convincing.
Let's get back again to the Vietnam sequences. Mao! Didi Mao! Do you think that the film is being racist? Do you think the film is trying to be racist, or is it accidentally? They do make it easy for us to hate the Viet Cong and the Russian roulette sequences.
Yeah, I suspect that it's more Cimino just being a little oblivious. Just trying to get his point across about the war as hell, rather than this gross, oversimplified, hyperbolic portrayal of the Viet Cong as
I don't think
monsters.
We ever learned the names of any of those guys, or any of the ones in the later Russian roulette sequences. They're all just generic Asian guys.
Yeah.
And they actually did slap Walken, I think, De Niro as well. And that's one reason why you'll see a Walken at one point looks at, what was that about?
So they cast that guy. He was a local. They replaced somebody that wasn't working out. And they cast him specifically because he had this personal problem with Americans. Oh, yeah. And they knew he wouldn't have any problem being super mean to them.
And again, in those sequences, Michael gives up on Stevie when they put him in the cage because he won't do the Russian roulette properly. He actually does fire a bullet that grazes his temple, but he seems to be okay. Certainly didn't die, obviously. But then after that, Michael never gives up on him again. When Stevie can't hang on to the helicopter's skid, he falls in the water and Michael deliberately goes down in there and then he drags him out with his broken leg and as we learn later, he's paralyzed. Then he goes to the VA to visit with him. He seems to always be protective of him, but it's strange how at that one moment, he's savage. He says to Nikki, forget about him, he's dead.
Well, I think it's because he believes he can't save him and he's trying to save Nick. I think he just doesn't want Nick to overreact and do something stupid to try and stay.
Because the only chance they have is to stay strong and do the thing he wants to do, which is get more bullets in that gun.
Yeah.
Put an empty chamber in that gun. That's the only chance they have. So yeah, I guess in a way, Stevie has to be dead to them because they've got to focus on this one thing, which is true about soldiers. They can't think about the buddy they just lost if they've got to complete a mission. Mourn for him later, or maybe save him later. Maybe that buddy's hurt as Stevie is. But you can maybe get him out if you complete your mission properly. Yeah, it's funny. It's still a mission, even though they're not actually in the war, per se. They're POWs. I think I mentioned this on Taxi Driver, so I'll bring it up again now. Does De Niro's character go off to New York to become Travis Bickle? Not literally. They're not deliberately tied. And this court movie came out after Taxi Driver, of course.
Sure.
But Travis Bickle is a Vietnam veteran. We don't know why he's so screwed up.
And where does he send the prostitute home to?
Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
That's right. And both De Niro's characters in these two movies seem to be sexually repressed. Mm. In this movie, because he wants to be with Linda and can't be. And the other movie, we don't know why.
Although Andrew Saris, the critic, suggested the whole movie is a homosexual panic. He did not like The Deer Hunter. He says that, truthfully, he is in love with Nick, not Linda.
Could be.
That's why he has that big emotional, I love you at the end. And the movie is really bromantic. The whole first hour of them with the drinking and the touching and the singing to each other. And to being more into each other than they are to the women around them, for sure. Yeah. Even Steve with his wife. He seems more interested in hanging with his friends all day than getting married to Angela.
That's true, yeah. Well, the first half of the movie ends, before they go to Vietnam, with George Zunza playing piano for all of them. And they're being rowdy and silly. And then he's playing this dirge, I guess you might call it, this really sad kind of song on the piano, and they all just listen to it, and the next sequence is the Vietnam thing, where De Niro is flamethrowing that guy over in the Nam. And then the end of the movie is singing. Mm-hmm. And in both sequences, John's a key character. Zunza is part of their group, but he's not in the wedding party because he's singing in the choir, and then he has nothing to do with Vietnam. He doesn't work with them. He's the only one that doesn't. The five of them work together, but he owns that bar. I love the touch, though. At the end, when he's about to make the eggs, he briefly cries. Mm-hmm. No one else does. They all could have cried at that funeral, but we never see... I was right on the verge of tears in this moment, by the way. The movie got to me more than I remember it getting to me before.
It's very
But
authentic.
I love that touch. He starts to, and then you don't see him do it for very long. It's right back to making the eggs. Mm-hmm. And nobody seems to know what to say. There are all these buddies been hanging out together. De Niro streaks earlier in the film. I think it's the first male nudity we've seen in the project so far.
Yeah,
you don't really see him, but he's clearly naked.
Well, no, you do. You see him. You see full frontal nudity.
Did you actually see it? Okay, I must have been looking down taking a note or something.
Well, maybe some of us were looking closer than others.
De Niro's wang makes it on the camera. But yeah, these guys are partying and playing around with each other and goofy and silly. De Niro's not a guy who's played silly very often, but early in the movie he's certainly doing that, and then towards the end, all of them are somber.
And it's when he's trying to comfort himself that he starts singing God Bless America. Mm-hmm. He starts just humming it, and it's him trying to get himself out of that choked up moment.
I think that's an uplifting sequence. I don't think it's meant to be negative.
There's hope. There's absolutely hope. Mm-hmm. They're going to be okay, but there's a new normal, and they're never going to be as carefree as they were before.
Well, I was reading online that Roy Scheider had the Michael role first, but then I was also reading he was supposed to be Steven. I don't know which it was, but he pulled out right towards the end. And considering that you also read that De Niro did all kinds of research and got Chuck Aspergren to be in the movie and worked a lot with Cimino before they even did the movie, I think it doesn't make sense that he would have been the main character. He would have had to be a lesser character like Steven.
I read it was Steven, and then they replaced him with John Savage.
And Brad Dourif was also in the running for that. He would have been an interesting choice. Savage was very good.
Savage was great.
And Savage will be in Do the Right Thing very briefly, one of the only white people in the whole film.
He's the gentrifier?
Yeah, he scuffs bugging out shoes, and that starts a, not a fight, but a little argument. It's kind of a fun sequence, actually. All right, Michael Cimino, this was obviously his crowning achievement. He was the triple threat by writing, directing, and producing, but many other people got writing credit. There's a whole lengthy thing on that Wikipedia about this, about who actually wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
Derek Washburn, who only ever wrote four scripts, including Silent Running, and the guys named Garfinkel and Redeker. All four of them are credited as either story guys or the actual screenplay writer, and they all were nominated for the Oscar. But then Cimino, who has just sold a lot of people down the river about this movie, he said he wrote it himself. And there's Washburn was a screw-up, apparently, and I don't know.
There's all these disputes about who did what. There's a dispute about the script. There's a dispute about editing as well.
Cimino said he edited the film.
Yeah, and everything ends with Cimino saying, screw them, I did everything. Mm-hmm. I edited that film.
And often
myself.
A director will do every single job. You know, James Cameron's been said to know everybody's job better than they do. But hell, I don't think you made this kind of huge epic all by yourself. This was his second directorial effort, though. That's pretty impressive to be number two and be this good. And he's directed nothing since 1996. And a big reason for that would be Heaven's Gate, which nearly ruined him. He's only made four movies since.
Yeah, his follow-up to Deer Hunter was Heaven's Gate, which frequents lists of the worst films ever made.
Have you seen it?
No.
I haven't either. I am curious because people now, when they talk about it, the last maybe 5 or 6 years, say, that's not a bad film after all. I think this is a classic example of everybody, Hollywood and certainly critics, that want to just tear somebody down. Maybe Cimino behind the scenes was way worse than we're even saying now.
And it sounds like he was...
Fuck that guy.
Yeah, he had a
personality
issue.
Even if he made Godfather Part 2 all over again, as good as Godfather Part 2 was, or made The Deer Hunter Part 2 as good as this was, it maybe wouldn't have mattered. They maybe would have sold him down the river anyway. I'm not excusing it. I've never seen the film. I talk about this as somebody who doesn't even know what I'm talking about with that one movie in particular. But it seems like they want to just roast him.
I read this great review by Vincent Canby about Heaven's Gate that said, "The film fails so completely that you might suspect Mr. Cimino sold his soul to the devil to obtain the success of the Deer Hunter, and the devil has just come around to collect."
For Heaven's Gate, yeah.
For Heaven's Gate, because it was so bad.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should watch it one of these days. It is long, I know that.
Maybe he had a little bit of George Lucas syndrome. His ego was so out of control. Enough success with Deer Hunter, people stopped putting checks and balances on him. Left to his own devices, he really couldn't make a good movie. I'm not saying he's not talented. I think that Deer Hunter, flawed though it may be, there is so much genius in it. What he puts on camera is so striking. The cinematography, the locations, the way every shot is lit and set is gorgeous. There's so much activity and motion. The camera's always moving. It's really kinetic. It's very entertaining, even like that long wedding sequence where there isn't all that much happening. You don't feel bored. Visually, it's so compelling, and I think he deserves credit for that. Maybe he's not the world's greatest storyteller. There's flaws in that, and there's definitely overkill. But just scene for scene, shot for shot, genius work.
I'm with you on that, and he would certainly say it is.
As well. He would agree, and then he would tell me that he did everything, he was responsible for everything.
And he just wrote the lines you just said, actually. He wrote the reviews, right. He screened the film for critics, he was a projectionist, did all that stuff.
Speaking of screenings, he apparently sabotaged versions of the film in screenings that he didn't want them to pass. So there were shorter versions that he bribed the projectionist to sabotage so that those people at those screenings would give it a worse review than the version that he liked. Which was long.
Well, one of the producers, in addition to Cimino, was Michael Dealy, who also produced Blade Runner. He didn't make a ton of movies, but he was a guy involved. I think it was with EMI. I mentioned them off the top. It's not a company we will mention very often. But they're the ones that made the movie. Universal bought it later on. So they released it, but EMI actually got it made. Mm-hmm. Martin Scorsese has mentioned this many times. I don't necessarily think it's ripping on it, although maybe it is. The end of the director's era of the 70s, when he made Taxi Driver and all these personal films other people made, came because of Heaven's Gate, because it cost so much motherfucking money.
Yeah, that's when the production company
said, enough is enough. This movie went over budget. Over budget, but Heaven's Gate went way over budget. All right, so Cimino's 2.35:1 print, which is blown up to 70mm, would have looked great on the big screen, I think. And we also got to see the Blu-ray.
And it looks beautiful. And the audio is amazing, too. The sound design, which they worked really hard on.
Stereo was getting to be a thing now.
It shows. Absolutely exceptional. Starting with the scenes in the steel mills, the way that they built the sound.
We learned a lot about steel mills early on. I feel like I could maybe go make some steel.
Seems
next
like
week.
The bowels of hell. Like, I don't know. Would I rather go to Nam or work in one of those steel
maybe
mills?
Maybe that's a metaphorical point there, too.
Maybe.
The cinematographer, Vilmos Zsigmond, we mentioned him just last week because he did shoot Close Encounters of the Third Kind and didn't seem to be buddies with Spielberg. The editor, Peter Zinner, who did cut the two Godfather films we've already covered, although Cimino claims, fuck that guy, I cut it myself. Now, Zinner's track record suggests he's a great editor, so I don't know what the truth is on that. The music, Stanley Myers, a name I've never heard before, an English composer, actually. He worked for more than 35 years. And the music that plays, that really gentle, soft music that plays, is actually quite nice.
I disagree. Okay. I didn't like it. I thought it was distracting, and it was treacly, and it was too melodramatic.
Did the score play a lot? I remember it playing the very opening.
There's a
couple
of scenes where it sticks out. There's parts where you probably don't notice it nearly as much. The scene I'm thinking of in particular is where De Niro's in the hotel. He's just kind of having a little private mental breakdown, and there's this terrible piano music playing
in the
background.
Oh, I didn't
notice that. Oh, it's so distracting. I hated it. So I am not behind this otherwise very popular with everyone else score.
And you haven't been with many of the scores we've covered.
No, I'm not a score fan most of the time.
Okay, The Influence. It's influenced by Best Years of Our Lives. You Can't Go Home Again. Lord of the Rings has that same kind of thing going on, and that's our last movie on the project. The Deer Hunter started filming a month after Star Wars came out, and here you got a 180 and a real war, unlike the fake wars that George Lucas put out there. After the Deer Hunter politics and winning a lot of Oscars like it did, that probably hurt next week's film, Apocalypse Now, which is one of my favorite films of all time. I will use the word genius. And I think that this movie's success probably hurt that one because a lot of people did the same thing they did to Cimino with Heaven's Gate and said, fuck you, we're not going to reward Apocalypse Now 2.
And they just sat through a 3-hour dour war epic.
Only a few months apart. Deer Hunter got screened for critics really late in 78, and then didn't come out until February of 79. Yeah. Apocalypse Now is, I believe, a summer release, so it was only a few months apart in actual release for people to watch. And that probably didn't help Apocalypse Now's chances either. The Deer Hunter's awards and AFI lists is not huge, but it's impressive when it comes to Oscars. It won 5 of them. Best Picture, Best Director for Cimino, Supporting Actor for Walken, the editing by Zinner, and apparently Cimino, although he didn't take home an award, and that sound you like so much. 4 failed nominations. all pretty big. De Niro for Best Actor. One other thing we got to say about him is that he doesn't talk about this movie. When he was on Inside the Actor Studio, they covered all of his movies. He's not a very verbose actor, so they were able to cover so many of his movies. He doesn't go on for 5 minutes like I do about things. But they do not talk about that movie, and I thought maybe they just had to cut it out. You can't put everything into a one-hour TV show. Yeah. I don't know really why. I guess it was the hardest movie he ever shot. And I also read somewhere that the sequence when he goes to visit Stevie in the VA was the hardest emotional scene he ever did shoot.
That scene! In that movie, I would never peg that scene as the most emotional one. Maybe because he's restrained, and maybe it's the restraint that's hard for him, rather than when he's actually in the POW camp.
Maybe he hadn't experienced his own life with a friend who went through the same thing and had to live it out, that Stevie, John Savage, is pretending to be paralyzed and lose his legs, but there really is somebody that he knows, a family member even. I don't know, I've never read this, just speculating, that maybe it hit too close to home for him more than anything else did. He can't relate to the taxi driver stuff, but maybe in this case he could. The other failed nominations, Meryl Streep for Supporting Actress, the screenplay by Cimino and those other three guys, and the cinematography by Zsigmond. The Duke, John Wayne, incidentally, and ironically, presented Best Picture that year, and he was not a fan of this kind of movie. But one thing about John Wayne people have always said is he was a pretty classy guy. He also accepted Gary Cooper's Oscar for High Noon, a movie that he openly trashed, certainly in the years that followed. So I guess John Wayne can get past the bullshit of it and just say, this movie won the award, congratulations. And he was dying of cancer. Nice little link to John Cazale. Deer Hunter made the National Film Registry in 1996, and the only other AFI recognition was of his 30th on the Top 100 Thrills, and that would be primarily, obviously, for the Russian Roulette sequences. Many nominations for AFI lists that didn't make the Top 100 quotes with, this is this. Top 100 songs for God Bless America, and Michael as a Top 50 hero, kind of like an encapsulation of people that had to go through this shit and then soldier on in life.
And he is a hero. He's a real hero because he's human and he struggles and it's hard for him. I totally agree with that characterization.
And the one thing we see him do in the bona fide Vietnam sequences is he's killing somebody who just killed a bunch of kids and women.
Yeah. I have a question. Was God Bless America, that was a standard American song before...
I know. Right? This is another situation where you get a song that was previously recorded by somebody else, but it was on the AFI list. I don't know if any of the songs, or certainly not very many of them that made the list, were songs from before. But in this case, it was. Next week, Apocalypse Now, The End. Absolutely should have made that list. But not a song that was written for the movie, specifically. I don't know when they pick and choose how that applies. It's, the songs list is very odd, and it's not a very good list to begin with. All right, last thoughts. Our only movie from 1978. I don't know if a lot of others had a really good chance. Superman and Grease were big hits.
53 is a little high, in my opinion. I'm surprised that it went up, because it seems like the type of film that the AFI is losing favor
I will answer that, speculate about this. We're talking 2007.
More voters who would have personally experienced...
Oh, that too, but also Afghanistan and Iraq. You had a lot of war veterans coming home and dealing with some of these same things, and way worse, because as bad as war veterans had to deal with their physical injuries and everything else from World War II, from Korea, from Vietnam, what we see now is even worse because of the kind of weapons that people have over there. People get their faces melted off. They live, but they look nothing like they used to.
That's a very good point. You know, it's not a movie that I'm going to want to watch once a year, but it is a damn good picture that has scenes worth viewing, for sure.
So if it was number 97 or something, you'd be fine with it.
Yeah, I think that would be a little more, that'd be a little better. 53 seems a little enthusiastic. Yeah, you're right. Some sentiment might have been going its way.
Good film. I think I'd put it on the list, but as I said, probably in the 90s. So at least it's represented, but maybe not quite as high as in the mid-50s. Okay, up next on the Top 100 Project is our 100th AFI motion picture.
Yes! We've reached chronologically.
100. We're done! Oh, not really. It's another Vietnam War epic, Francis Ford Coppola's big screen, big sound stunner, Apocalypse Now. The coming attractions trivia for Apocalypse Now. How many AFI films did Marlon Brando, Robert Duvall, Dennis Hopper, and Harrison Ford appear in total?
All four of them?
Those four guys, they're total AFI films. Not that hard to find.
All right, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. And if you would like to reach us personally, please send us an email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. Once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Fuck it.
And cut.